I've had so much fun with Mike's 5th and 6th graders at Ann Arbor Open Mac this past winter. Ann Arbor Open's already a thriving community, so I just knew that digging for stories would be a natural process. We've been working on a family storytelling project, and we'd like to share some of the stories that came out after asking lots of questions, visiting with relatives, and sharing tales with fellow classmates. The project was intended to show Mike's students that their own stories and those of their parents or grandparents or siblings are of great value. They teach us about details in history, and they help us understand our place in the circle of the family. The stories reminded us that there are all kinds of families, and that even the silliest little tales can bring a person or a memorable moment back to life in a unique way. Getting together as a class to share the stories is a little like a family sitting around a table. Kids get such a kick out of the wacky things their parents did. Here's Mira and Serena with funny stories to share.
When my sister was little, my dad's family used to own this restaurant. And so my sister had to sleep in the restaurant because everybody, the whole family is working. So where she used to sleep was in a box behind the counter. So one day the health department came to give the certificate to my dad for the restaurant. So the woman came in and she went to look around the counter, and she looked down and she saw my little sister, my older sister, just scrawled up in a box laying in it. So she went to my dad and she was like, "Oh my gosh, what in the world?" And she went to my dad and said, "I'm sorry, but you will have to remove that little girl immediately. She is so hazardous to this restaurant." So my dad had to have my sister sleep in the kitchen with my grandma.
My mom is a very smart person, and she enjoys thinking outside the box, or in this case, the playpen. It was a few days before Christmas, and I was 1 year old. My parents were cooking dinner in the kitchen, and suddenly they heard a whoosh and a whee! They ran into our blue-colored living room. They saw the Christmas tree had fallen on me, and all they could see were my feet. So, of course, they rushed over to me and lifted the Christmas tree off of me, and I was just laying there, shattered ornaments all around me, and I was giggling, having the best time of my life. That's when the playpen took action. Instead of putting me in the playpen, my mom put the Christmas tree in the playpen so I wouldn't be able to pull it over again. When my brother was born, my mom knew that it might happen again and he might pull the Christmas tree down, so she put it in the playpen again. So no more tree for me.
As the storytellers talked, we realized that stories about things that we can taste and touch and hear, stories that appeal to our senses, seem to survive and be passed down through the generations. Logan, Leo, Devin, and May all have stories about food and drinks that stick with us.
This story takes place 65 years ago. It starts when my grandma was very little, about the first or second grade. In our neighborhood, there were more boys than girls, which is probably why she had a friend who was a boy. His name was Stuart, and his dad was an artist, and she liked going to his house a lot, because since his dad was an artist, their house had a lot of different colored walls. Another thing she liked was that they had potato chips. She came from one of the more old-fashioned families, and when potato chips first came out, her family didn't let her get them. So she used to go over to his house and have like a bologna sandwich for lunch with potato chips. And when I came over to her house, she showed me a picture of her and Stuart walking to school with books on her arm, and I thought it was cool because she looked so old-fashioned. I thought about the story, and I thought it might tie in with the fact whenever I go to my grandparents' house, there's always lots of potato chips around.
When my mom was in high school, a friend of hers gave her a bunch of pecans as a present for the holidays. She decided to do something nice for the family and make a bunch of pecan pies. She started collecting the ingredients when she realized they didn't have any corn syrup. So she called upstairs to her mom and her mom said that she could use molasses instead of corn syrup. So she used the molasses instead of the corn syrup and put all the ingredients together. She thought that it looked a bit thick when she put it together, but she had never made a pie before, so she went with it. When the pie was in the oven, it started to smell funny, and when she took it out, it was as hard as a rock. She tried dropping it on the floor to see if it would break. It didn't. She was really embarrassed and sad that she had wasted the pecans.
So when I was 3 months old, my mom and my dad took me to a restaurant, and my mom had ordered something with jalapenos in it. And I was reaching for one, and she gave me one thinking that I would cry and not try to do it again so it would teach me a lesson. But I had a grin on my face and I smiled and I was reaching for more. And she just gave me the rest of them. And now I still like jalapenos.
Okay, so it was one hot summer and I was over at my friend's house across the street. Her name is Anna. And we were playing in the forest outside. And we were all really tired and really hot, so we went inside, and her mom was like, "Do you guys want some lemonade?" And so we were like, "Sure." And so we were drinking our lemonade at the counter, and then my friend Anna was like, "Hey, May, why do you hold your pinky up while you drink?" And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And so then I tipped the cup over to check, and I spilled all the lemonade onto my lap.
One day, someone told a story about sleepwalking. And the next thing you knew, we were all telling stories about strange things that happened in our sleep. Like Lila's story, Julian's, and Justin's, they all have interesting stories about sleeping.
So when my dad was 6 or 7, he went out with his family to Colorado, and they stayed in a cabin owned by the YMCA. And one day, they came home from skiing all day, and my dad was really tired, so he went to bed. And he was dreaming, and suddenly he felt this cold on his feet. And he started to wake up, but he wasn't fully awake when he realized that he could hear the birds chirping. And he was fully awake now and realized that he was outside in the snow. He said out loud, "How did I get here?" And so he ran back inside and his mom asked him, "Where have you been?" And he said, "I don't know." And he went back to bed. And this time when he dreamt, his feet were very warm.
All right, so I'm a big sleepwalker. I sleepwalk a lot. And so one night I was just sleeping, and then I woke up in my bed. And so then I just went back to sleep, not thinking. And then I woke up on the couch in my room, and I was like, "Whoa, what the heck is going on?" And then I woke up in my brother's bed, and he was like, "Julian, get out of here." I'm like, "Okay." And apparently, I learned when I had woken up in the morning, my dad told me that I had stood up and gone, "Move over, I gotta pee," to my brother. And he had said, "Julian, this isn't the bathroom." I'm like, "Oh, yeah." So then I walked over to the closet, and he was like, "Julian, that's not it either." And then, so finally, he was just like, "Dad, come up here." And my dad brought me down to the bathroom. And that's my sleepwalking story.
One time when I was really little, and I was about 5 years old, my mom was making dinner because my dad was away because he's a Civil War reenactor. And it was near Christmas time, so she was going out to put lights on our tree. And she accidentally locked herself out of the house while I was asleep. And our oven, when it gets like crumbs left in it from cooking other things, then it starts to set off the smoke alarm when you cook things sometimes. So I was asleep and the smoke alarm started going off, and my mom had to wait for my dad to get home so he could get her inside the house. And I slept through the whole thing.
There's a classic motif in folklore, the trickster tale, one of my favorites. But it also shows up in family stories. So I was delighted that Emily, Elena, and Linus had stories about tricks.
Well, my family and I went to Boston to visit our friends. And the first morning we were there, well, I woke up and my sister and my friend were downstairs with my dad, and they were copying what he did. And then I started copying what he did. And then after a couple minutes, he started getting annoyed. So he walked outside. And then my friend walked outside after she put on shoes and a coat. I walked outside after I put on shoes. And then my sister just walked right outside. So my dad took us down the path a little ways. And then he bolted back into the house and locked us out. We started banging on the door and he wouldn't let us in. So we went around to the side door. And there was my friend's little sister just standing there. She was kind of teasing us, and we were begging her to let us in. And after a while, she did.
So when my dad was in sixth grade, he lived in Springfield, Pennsylvania. And his classroom was on the first floor, but the basement in the school came out about halfway out of the ground. So he's on like the first and a half floor or something. Mm-hmm. And so one day his friends and him were looking out the window, and one of his friends said, "I bet you can't jump out the window." And my dad said, "I bet I can, but you have to give me each a quarter." So they agreed to that, and in the middle of the class, my dad got up and walked to the window and opened it, and he jumped out. And his teacher was a good teacher, and he didn't really make a big deal out of it. He just said to my dad that he would have to see him after class. And so after class, the teacher sent him to the vice principal. And the vice principal, and so my dad sat down. The vice principal told him that it could have been dangerous and he shouldn't do that, and he would get detention for a week. But my dad said that his teacher already said that he would give him detention. So the vice principal said that was okay, and so my dad went back to his teacher, and his teacher said that he would give him detention for a week. But my dad said that the vice principal would give him detention for a week. So he didn't have to, he just went home every day because he didn't have to get detention. And so, and that teacher still tells the story of the boy who jumped out the window to this day.
So every year, my extended family goes to a beach on the ocean, for a long time, I don't know if it's ever been different, we've been to, it's a cluster of islands off North Carolina, and it's in a city called Nag's Head, and we usually go to, since my extended family is really big, a really big house that has around 5 stories, not including the basement. Each family will bring a lot of their Nerf guns and have Nerf wars. We also have a little cottage called Spider Villa. So, Spider Villa is pretty much the opposite. It's small, and it's close to the beach. It's cut into the dune, so it makes a kind of hallway. And you can just go there for 2 minutes and come back without having to cross the big dunes and the underbrush. We've had Nerf wars, generally. And we couldn't do that this year since the family split up. Since Christmas, the other house, which was called McMullen, the people in that house decided to technically raid our house with their Nerf guns. And the families all bought, like, the newest Nerf guns. And so this pretty much went as it was planned. I saw them crossing the road or coming to Spiderville. And they were in a group and they had face paint and they had camouflage headbands and belts. So they looked like they were basically an Indian tribe coming with Nerf guns. So they raided us, and then they shot us with Nerf guns. But then after that, they just left their Nerf guns lying around, and then they went to the beach. And I have a picture of everyone standing on the steps of Spiderville. And so we took and hid the Nerf guns that they had left around. We hid them, I think, in the bedrooms and eventually in a cousin's trunk. I hope they don't melt. After that, we made up a nickname that was Spider Villains and put face paint on the back of our hands and on our face. And it was a picture, a symbol of a spider for Spider Villa. And we also made up a secret handshake.
Grandfather and great-grandfather stories added depth to this collection by giving us a sense of history. Both Avery and Sam have fascinating tales of long ago.
So my grandpa, when he was a kid, he lived in kind of a small town in North Dakota. And so his dad was pretty good friends with, like, the sergeant and stuff. So him and his friends used to always go down and put juice box on the train tracks and watch the train just come and just truck them, just bury them. And one day his dad got kind of suspicious because he was out pretty late all the time. So his dad went and followed him one day and saw what he was doing. So his dad kind of plotted for revenge. So like I said in the beginning, his dad was pretty good friends with the sheriff. So his dad told the sheriff what he was doing, and the sheriff didn't have a problem with it. But my grandpa's dad said that the sheriff should follow him and, like, fake arrest him and stuff. So the sheriff put him in his, followed him, and then when he was there, he put him in his car, took him to the police station, and then my grandpa's dad came, and he like, kind of didn't act, and he was, like, really, he acted like he was really mad, even though he was trying so hard not to laugh. And when he got him out, he just started cracking up in the car, and my grandpa said, "What's so funny? I just got arrested." And then my grandpa's dad said, "No, you didn't get arrested. That would be in the sheriff's plan the whole entire time."
The year was 1944 in Frederick, Oklahoma. My great-grandfather was learning how to fly his first combat-type airplane. He went with the flight instructor Bill Watterson, and they went up to 10,000 feet in the airplane, and they practiced some stalls. When it was going, everything was going fine, so they practiced a different stall, and that the stall, something went wrong, so they went into inverted flight, and it wasn't controlled at all. So they had to, the major said to bail out. And the second guy on the controls that day, A.K. Pier, had to jump on the hatch to get out. So the hatch flew with him out of the plane. And so my great-grandfather went, like, jumped out of the hatch too. But then the major had to dive on the hatch, and he hit his head. And there was a big knot on it afterwards. So they escaped from the plane, and my great-grandfather and a.k.a. Pierre, landed in a cotton patch. And don't get the idea, it was soft. It was really uncomfortable. So they landed a half a mile away from the plane, and A.K. Pierre had hurt his back, like, really bad, like, broke his back, and the major sprained his both of his ankles and wrenched his back. So, but my great-grandfather was fine. So once they could walk again, they found the plane, which was about half a mile away, and so they walked back to the, flight place, the Air Force Base, and the plane crash is still listed as an unknown cause to this day.
Of course, outdoor adventure stories play a prominent role in most of our childhood tales, and we shared plenty of zingers. Emma, Skip, Corey, Zane, and Ian all had escapades from smelly fish to London games.
When my mom was 5, she lived in London, and her mom, my grandma, went to pick flowers because they had a huge dinner party, and they were getting flowers for vases. And then they started playing hide and seek, but she kind of got lost, and my grandma thought that she went home. So she walked home, but then my mom was still hiding behind a tree. But then a gardener found her and walked her home. And then, yeah, she found my grandma.
Me and my dog and my friend Simon were down at the pond, and we were catching snakes. And we had caught about 20, and we started smelling really nasty stuff, and it was like, oh my God, I don't want to smell that. And we were trying to find it, and also at the same time trying to get stuff caught. So my dog Raven, he wasn't near us, and he was trotting around somewhere, I don't know where. And then I noticed that the smell got intense when he started coming towards us, and his mouth was kind of pried open. And it was, like, really something I didn't want to touch. So I told him to drop it, and he growled at me and told me he didn't want it. And Dog Lagoon told me he didn't want to drop it. So then he kept on, like, trying to turn his head so that I couldn't get to it. I tried to pry it out of his mouth, and I couldn't get it out. So I yelled at him to drop it, and he dropped it. And then I picked it up, and it was like a yucky piece of meat or rotten stuff. And I didn't want to smell it anymore, so I told him to eat it real quick. And so then he ate it, and he went back for more. So me and my friend Simon followed him and found a big pike that was just rotting, and flies were all over it and flying around, and looked like they were laying eggs in it. So Raven kept on, like, nudging it and eating at it. So me and Simon, the smell was so bad that we had to go back. And we did, and we found that Raven still wanted more. And he also wanted to be near us. So he took a big part of it and came to us, which happened to be the head. It looked like a zombie, kind of. And I picked up the head and I threw it in the water, and he went and he got it and attempted to eat more of it before I could take it, but I got it and I threw it back, and he couldn't get it that time, so he was kind of mad, and I told him and I held him so he couldn't go get any more, but then he threw up, so we had to go back, and me and my friend Simon had only caught like 20 or something like that by the time he was feeling better, but we still had to go up because we didn't want him to get sick anymore.
When in the summertime, a couple years ago, I went down to Kentucky, my great-grandma's hometown, and we went to the graveyard to see my great-grandpa because he died before my mom was born. And we were in the campground, and there was a pool, and we went swimming, and me and my cousin Hallie, And there's like steps and there's a pool. We walked down like we're so fancy and cool and everything. Then a little bit later, me and my cousin were playing Mayday. We didn't know what Mayday means, so we thought it was just a cool name to play with. So we started playing it. Then like a half an hour later, me and my cousin got in this tube together because our butts were small enough. And I wanted to get out, but so I put my head underwater, tried to get out, but I got stuck from the tube and my cousin, and my head was underwater. So I was kicking my legs really hard. Then I guess my mom saw me. Then she told my dad, and my dad like threw my cousin out of the tube. Then he like picked me up. He was like, "Are you okay?" I'm like, "Yeah." The next day, my uncle didn't want to get in the water. He was all in his shorts, shoes, and a shirt. And my like four or five of my second cousins picked the chair up and threw him in the water. But he had his wallet and keys in there. So he gave the keys to my grandma. Then he got out. He was like, "Seriously, guys?"
When my dad was in first grade, he lived in Monterey, California, and his brother had just gotten a new bike. And the bike was too big for him to reach the pedals, but he really wanted to ride. So one day, he took the bike up the street a couple of blocks, and in Monterey, the streets go up and down and across the hill, and the ones going up and down go straight into the bay. And so he got up a couple, three blocks, and then started coming down, and he picked up a bunch of speeds because his feet couldn't reach the pedals, and it was coaster brakes. And so when he got to a street, he was about to turn in when a car was starting to come out of that street. So he could either go straight into the bay with the sea lions or turn in front of the car. And he chose to turn in front of the car, and he hit the curb. The bike flew into his neighbor's yards, and as soon as he hit the ground, he started running home. And when he got inside, he said, "Mom, I could have been killed."
It was a hot summer when it's like 2007. I was about 7 years old, and there's a pond right outside my house. And so I had some friends, and we were just around the house. And so they decided it would be a smart idea to try to go sailing across the pond. And so they decide they don't know how to build a boat, so they're just going to get these big plastic tubs and see how it works. And so there's three people who are trying to do it. So this one girl goes out. She decides it's a really bad idea and turns back. Another boy goes out, and he gets stuck in the middle of the pond, and he's just sort of there for a while. But then my friend Noah, he goes out. He gets, like, to the middle. He falls out, and he's soaked and covered in mud. And he has to walk all the way back, and so... But he has a hockey game, and so his mom just told him to take a shower before he went. And so we had to put him in a bucket, cover him in a blanket, and sneak him into his room so his mom wouldn't notice him covered in mud. And so he's changing, and then his mom knocks on his door, and he's like, "Are you ready to go to the hockey game?" And he says, "Yeah."
We discovered that place played such an important role in stories from our past. Summer camp, Sleeping Bear Dunes, Lost Valley Ranch are the colorful places that Miranda, Issa, and Leika took us to with their nostalgic tales.
Every year, me and my brother go down to this camp called Varsity Day Camp near an A&W in Canton. This was the second year that my brother couldn't go because he was far too old by now. So I'm going down and I'm all alone. The first and second days are fairly normal, but the third day I get there, something big happened. This is what happened. I was going swimming in the lake. There was nothing much to do, and I was just going to go for a free swim period in the next period. Instead, I see Chaz, one of the counselors, out by the rafts of the swimming area. He calls out to the counselor to take the children on his boat off. Everybody by now has noticed that there's something wrong with Chaz's paddle boat. It seems to be getting lower and lower in the water. But the point that the people have noticed it's Ron. Chaz has gotten up onto the raft, and a turtle boat is going over to try and get the paddle boat out of the water. Chaz and his kids are in complete chaos. Chaz is screaming. The kids are laughing. The kids are also screaming. Chaz is screaming, "I saw old Gray's giant eyes in his giant mouth." Now, Old Gray is the rumored legend of a gigantic snapping turtle, although some people think he's a soft shell, who lives in the deep lake of Varsity Day. There's supposedly a picture of him somewhere. I've never seen the picture myself, but I have heard about it. So, right now I have this imaginary picture of a giant turtle with great red eyes biting a paddle boat. I look up at Chaz and I say, "Chaz, don't lie. What really happened?" Chaz says, "It's true! It's true!" And all of his kids agree with him. So now I'm pretty curious. Chaz is still screaming about his great red eyes, and the kids are still laughing and screaming. And by this point, they've gotten the paddle boat about halfway to the shore. Now the kids have told everybody, and everybody has ran up the hill to go to the upper part of the camp and tell everybody what happened. So by the time all the kids get down, what they've heard is that Chaz got bit, his leg bitten off by Old Gray. That's not actually what happened, so a great deal of explaining was needed by the kids who were actually there. So now there's a group of all the counselors who were on the beach at the time talking to Chaz. Chaz still thinks that Old Gray took a giant bite out of his boat. Kathy, the most logical of all the counselors, says, "No way, it was just some seaweed that pulled out the plug, Chaz, don't exaggerate." Some of the counselors aren't quite sure. And Mike, the counselor who has a picture of Sasquatch on his phone, says it was definitely true. So, finally they're getting the boat up from the mud. The soft mud around the shoreline has caused it to sink even further into the mud, and it takes a great deal of pulling and a couple of ropes to try and get it to wrench free. They're dragging it up and everybody's gathered around there, and I have a front row seat. They're finally dragging it up out of the mud and onto the shore. It's coated with mud and dirt and sand from the ground and the water. So a couple of kids grab some buckets that are supposed to hold turtles and fish and pour water on the boat so that all the mud comes off. Now we can tell that there's something definitely wrong. A giant area of twisted white plastic around the base of the boat is clearly visible, and it looks like something took a great big bite out of it. Everybody is silent. And someone, far in the deep edges of the crowd, says, "My gosh." And everybody starts yelling, and everybody starts trying to figure out if this is even possible. Because some people believe in Old Gray and some people don't. Kathy and a lot of the other counselors are completely dumbfounded. Chaz is freaking out even more, which I didn't think was possible before he did so. And Mike is getting a picture of it on his phone. So finally, they've told the kids to clear out and get to their activities. One of the older girls comes out onto the dock and lifts up a white flag, the signal that a new period of activity is going to start. I run up the hill as fast as I can to the life jacket track. I finally get up there and I yank on a life jacket, and I'm still pulling it on as I run down the hill. I'm the first in line to wait and get into the sailboat. Chaz, as a coincidence, is sailing that day. I get assigned to Chaz's boat. I'm finally out on the river after a long period of us trying to tell Chaz to calm down long enough to get the sail up. Finally, we're out on the boat. Everything seems fine now, and we can barely believe that we ever thought that Old Gray might possibly have existed. So we're looking around for something to tease Chaz with, because Chaz, a bit chunky, insecure, and the most scared of all the counselors, with his hipster glasses, of course, is really freaked out. We've only just now gotten him to stop trying to see what's in the water long enough to actually figure out where we're going. So we finally look down, and we see a giant blob of seaweed floating up on the top of the water. I lift up the seaweed and kind of tie it around my wrist. Chaz! Chaz! Old Gray, it's got me! This led to a period of complete chaos. Chaz was trying to prevent us from crashing into the imaginary Old Gray under us. He was trying to prevent the sail from hitting our heads, which he proved futile, so we just had to duck. And we were trying not to fall off of the boat with a combination of laughter and the fact that Chaz was going insane. We finally calmed ourselves down enough to stop laughing and stop screaming. By this point, the other sailboat and all the other boats are staring at us like we're insane, which I dare say we probably were. So finally, we've just sitting around. The wind isn't blowing very hard and it's really quite boring. So we have no idea what to do for another little while because we're not completely sure if we want to run the risk of the pole hitting our heads again. Eventually, we decide it's worth it. The kid next to me on the boat whips around and sees the bubbles that are behind us from Chaz trying to make us go faster. Chaz, Chaz, look! It's Old Gray's bubbles! He's under the water right now! Chaz launches a second period of chaos. By now, we've become kind of a traveling show, and all the other boats are just watching us like some kind of TV show. We don't really mind because it's hilarious to watch Chaz freak out, and quite easy to make him do so. So finally, Chaz calms down for the second time, and there's no longer any danger of us getting hit by the pole so we can straighten up. So I look down in the water. I'm still laughing slightly because Chaz still has the most hilarious expression on his face. I look down into the water and I see a weird shape. At first I think it's just a blob of seaweed, but then I notice that these giant blobs on either end of it seem to be moving. I nudge the kid next to me and I point at it. At first he thinks that I'm just pointing to another bit of seaweed, but when he sees the fins, he screams. Chaz whips around. I scream. Now we're all screaming. All of the kids are wondering what's wrong, because before we were laughing at least. So now everybody has no idea what's going on and is in complete confusion. Seemingly early, they yell red flag. It's lunchtime. So we get back to the shore and we go up. Everybody by now has told everybody that that they think we might have seen Old Gray. We are now on the shore long enough to have confirmed that story, and they've been there for long enough that everybody knows this story. I go up the hill and I'm still laughing with my friend. So we walk over to the area with peanut butter and jellies where we can eat our sandwiches. I sit down next to one of my best friends, and she shakes her head at me. I say, what? And she says, if Old Gray was there, you still shouldn't have told Chaz that. So I turn around, and I see Chaz. And he's flipping out. He looks like he's going to have a seizure. And he's just yelling that, get him inside! Old Gray is coming! So finally we get over there. We're like, Chaz, Chaz, calm down, calm down. We're sorry we teased you, man. Don't flip out. And he's like, but it was, so it wasn't real? We're like, yeah. And he's like, you guys are jerks.
So my mom and my aunt, they went to this place called Lost Valley Ranch every summer. It was in Colorado, and they went from Kansas. And so, like, when they were really close to this hill, they'd be driving on a one-way dirt road, and then they'd drive up the mountain, and when they got to the top of the mountain, there was this cowboy, and he greeted them every time. And so when they'd drive down, the cowboy would be riding right next to them. And then there were all these cabins, and each family had their own cabin. And then there was a main cabin where everybody ate. And there was, on the ceiling, there were these huge wooden beams, and there were all these, like, metal sticks with these symbols of people who've been to Lost Valley Ranch. And then there was this horse. There were horses, and my mom and my aunt, they got to ride horses. And my mom rode this horse named Nacho, and it was really small, and it was white and orange. And so when my mom was riding the horses, they went to the stream and they swam in the stream and then they had to go home. But when they were driving up the hill, my mom and my aunt they cried all the way home.
So I remember we went to Sleeping by Dunes with my dad and my sister, and well, we were walking up, and when we got there, we stepped on the sand. It was really, really warm, and we didn't want to get sand in our shoes, so we took off our shoes, and the sand was really, really hot. And so we were walking up, and we got really, really tired. And then eventually the sand cooled down, and we got used to it. And we were at the top of the dunes, and my dad said it was fun to run down the dunes. So we decided to run down the dunes, and I tripped, and I went rolling down the dunes instead of running down the dunes. And then, so when we got to the bottom, I unrolled my pants, and a whole bunch of sand came out. And a little bit after that, we went to my mom's house. We went to my mom, and then she said, "I think I have lice." I said, "No, it's sand." And then she said, "What?" I said, "I went rolling down the sand dunes."
There's nothing like an unusual journey to bring out a great story. And Callie and Natalie have theirs to share.
Okay, so when I was at overnight camp, the power went out for 3 days. And the lights wouldn't work, the water didn't run. So, like, if you had to go to the bathroom since the toilets didn't flush, you'd have to get the fire bucket, bring it to the well to fill it up, and then dump it into the back of the toilet so that it had water to flush with. So one night, I woke up and I really had to go to the bathroom. So I tried waking up my friend Carter, who was sleeping in the bunk above me. And I said, Carter, wake up. And then she didn't really move. And then she made this grunting sound that was like, I'm like, okay, that's not going to work. So I went to my friend Sophia, and she started sleepwalking, so, because she does that a lot. And then, so she kind of eventually went back to her bed. So I was about to get my flashlight to go by myself when I heard a voice behind me say, "I'll go to the bathroom with you, Collie." And so that scared me, so I turned around and said, "Oh, hi, Bridget." So we went outside to get the fire bucket, and then we walked down to the well near the lake to fill it up. And it's like a slope, so she slipped, and I grabbed her arm. And then we both got really wet, and the bucket eventually filled up. So we went back over to the bathroom with the extremely heavy water bucket. We came back to the well to fill it up, and when we got to the cabin, we put it back onto the ledge. And right when we did that, she said, "Collie, I have to go to the bathroom." And I looked at her for a minute and then said, "Bridget, go in the woods." And she looked at me like I was crazy. And then I'm like, "No, seriously, go in the woods. If you have to go to the bathroom, you're going to have to go in the woods because I'm not doing that again." So she went over to like little spot and went. So when we came back the next morning, the counselor from my cabin said, "Hey, guess what, guys? The power went back on last night."
About 20 years ago, after having the opportunity to visit Las Vegas several times, my mom decided to move there. She is planning her drive from Detroit to Las Vegas and decided to take the northern route through the mountains, even though it was the end of March and there might be bad weather. My grandfather had read an article in a magazine about women traveling alone and how blow-up dolls might be a good idea. The idea was that a single woman could travel with a doll, which would look like a passenger. Therefore, someone wouldn't be as likely to bother her. She researched blow-up dolls and found one, and she named him Monty. When she left Detroit, she wanted Monty to fit in, so she dressed him in a blue jean outfit, hat and all. At the time, it was a cool outfit. She had Monty with her and was zipping along. By the time the By the time they passed through Nebraska, she changed him into Western wear so he'd once again fit in. Now he had his cowboy boots, bandana, and a cowboy hat, along with the rest of his clothes. As they traveled through the snow-covered mountains, there was a terrible snowstorm with no visibility. She looked over at Monty and realized he was starting to rise and fall off his seat, and before she knew it, his head was touching the ceiling of the car. Luckily, she was able to keep her eyes on the road, one hand on the wheel, and pull him down by his bandana with her other hand. I hadn't thought about the high altitude affecting Monty. As she paid attention to other drivers, she noticed the look on their faces. I wondered what they were thinking and how effective this blow-up doll really was. That feeling was made clear when we pulled into a gas station. As the attendant began clearing the windshield, she saw the look on his face when she saw Monty. It was a combination of confusion and fear. Then she realized why traveling with a blow-up doll worked. It wasn't that people thought you were traveling with a companion. It was that people thought you were crazy and didn't want to go near you. She felt the need to roll down her window and explain. Oh yeah, this looks funny, but actually my dad read an article about women traveling with blow-up dolls. I'd be reciting this same story many times to come. That night, while choosing the hotel for the night, she realized how hard it was to leave Monty alone in the car. Even if no one else thought he was real, she was kind of attached to him. So she could either leave him in the car, alone and cold, or somehow take him into the hotel. She was thinking of tying his foot to mine and walking to her room. After she thought about it, she decided that it wasn't cold in the car, and Sally left him for the night. When she got to Las Vegas, she rented a house and had a special rocking chair for Monty. A few months later, a friend came over and hugged him so tight he popped. Now he's just a mere shell of a man, so her Monty story came to an end.
One person tells a story about getting lost, and the next thing you know, we all have dramatic stories on the same theme. As you'll see from Kyan, Jesse, and Ethan, you never forget these scary times from your childhood.
It all started when my family and I went to see my dad's softball game. It was sometime in the bottom of the seventh inning when I asked my mom if I could go to the bathroom. The bathroom was all the way across the park, and I was only seven, so my mom came with me. I just sat down when someone came in. They waited for a second, then flicked off the lights, locked the door, and slammed it as they left. I ran to the door and banged on it as hard as I could. I could just make out what my mom was yelling at me. It sounded like, "Just wait there and I'll get you out of there." So that's just what I did for about 5 minutes. But only after I tried unsuccessfully to find the light switch in the pitch black dark. It was one of the worst smelling bathrooms that I'd ever been in, and it was also one of the coldest. At last, I heard them walk up to the door and put the key in the keyhole. I hoped that it wouldn't take long because I wanted to get out of there. As they tried the fourth key, I hoped that it was the right key, and luckily it was. I walked out and was blinded because it was so light outside, and like I said, I couldn't find the light switch. As I came out, I thought to myself I had never been happier to see a maintenance man in my life. So that's the story of me getting locked in the public bathroom at Vets Park.
One time, when I was young, my family and I went to a hotel. If you were to look at it from the outside, you would think it was over 50 feet tall. The people who worked there were very nice and the beds were very comfortable, except the best part was they had a pool. So one time, my family and I decided to go swimming there, so we all got dressed in our swimming stuff and set off. When we got there, I was amazed at how big it was, and it was more crowded than anything I had ever seen before. I saw a couple of kids that only looked a few years older than me swimming in the deep end, and I thought, well, if they can swim in there, then surely I can as well. So I ran up to the edge and I jumped in. And I sank like a stone. My dad had to jump in the pool and get me out. And after that, I didn't want to go anywhere near the pool. Or water, as a matter of fact. The only time I would go near water was if it was in my kiddie pool, in my sippy cup, or in a rain puddle.
Hey. One time when I was in North Carolina, I got lost on the beach. Me, my stepdad, my mom, and my sister, and my stepdad's family all went there. And so we went to the beach, and we were just going in the water, like, searching for shells. So my sister told me to go search for some shells. So I did, and I walked, and I found this really cool shell. So I went down, and I picked it up, and I got turned around. So I started walking one way, and I was walking, and I was walking for about half an hour, and I was searching and I couldn't find them. So I turned around and started walking the other way. And I walked for about an hour and a half. And so I asked these people if they could help me find my family. And the sky was getting kind of dark clouds and it was starting to get a little stormy. So they said, oh no, we're leaving, we can't help you. So I asked a couple people and they all said that. And then I asked these two guys if they could help me and they said, oh yeah, sure, we'll help you find your family. So we walked for about 2 hours and we couldn't find them and the sand was getting really hot and the sky was getting more cloudy and cloudy, and then we kept on walking and walking, and they kept on saying that we're going to find your family. And then eventually they said, is that your dad? And then I said, yeah, that's my stepdad. And I was so excited that he was there searching for me. And so I ran over to him, and my stepdad thanked them for helping me, and we walked for about half an hour back. And since I didn't know the street that I was on and I was so little, my mom said, okay, now Ethan, remember this. You are at the house on Purple Martin Drive, and I still remember it.
We hope you enjoyed hearing these stories and that they'll spark memories for you. Remember what storyteller Ira Glass said, great stories happen to those who can tell them.